For the first time in history, we have eyewitness accounts of hell. People who've come back and said they've experienced hell, and it's horrendous. I mean, beyond anything you can imagine, just as the heavenly accounts are beyond anything we can imagine.
Yeah.
You're listening
to the Thinking Matters podcast.
Conversations
at the intersection of
faith,
culture,
and reason.
Welcome to the Thinking Matters podcast for another exciting episode. My name is Todd Funk, and today I'm honored to be joined by Dr. Orson Wedgwood. Orson, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Yeah. For those of you who don't know, Orson has a PhD in organic medicine chemistry in the UK. He's an author. He's published both fiction and nonfiction books and discussion forum on the science of consciousness and near-death experiences, which will be our topic for today. And Orson, I've got tons of questions for you. And I don't want to be spooky spiritual, but this is going to be great. I know it because we've had so many technical glitches. So welcome to the show.
There's definitely opposition in the realms outside of the technical, it seems.
Yes, for sure. Well, so before we jump into our topic of the day, tell me, because I don't know anything about you. Tell me about your spiritual journey. How and when did you come to Christ?
Okay, so I grew up in England. I went to a school which was supposedly a church school, but it's Church of England, and it was very nominal. Like, we'd have to sing psalms in Latin, among other things. And the school chaplain was more interested in Buddhism than he was in anything else. So, however, I from an early age just had a real I had an interest in Jesus and believed in him. And I became confirmed in the Church of England when I was 13 years old. I was one of few in my year who did that. But I wouldn't say that I was, you know, born again at that stage. I just sort of believed, and like many people in our culture, believed that Christianity was just one of a number of ways of, you know, finding God and experiencing him. And I had quite a rocky patch through my teens, to say the least. I wouldn't say I was in a particularly Christian family. It was a nominal Christian family, not an active, proper born again Christian family. And I sort of went well off the rails, got involved in activities, kind of flunked out of school, and sort of hit the buffers a little bit. I did go to college, and got some what we call in England college, not university. But while I was there, I met a girl, and she was a Christian, and she eventually dragged me into a Pentecostal church where I encountered the Holy Spirit for the first time. And then after various things happened, I became a Christian there and was born again at the age of 19.
That's awesome. That's funny. You're my second guest in a row that had kind of dated a Christian girl and slipped and fell into the river, so to speak. Yeah. And Orson, what do you do with your free time? Do you have hobbies or any, you know, passionate activities you like doing outside of work and whatnot?
Yeah, I mean, I do write. That's one of my hobbies. I spend quite a lot of time answering questions on my blog and engaging with mostly non-Christians, although there are Christians on there. It is mostly non-Christians around, you know, questions specifically around the research into near-death experiences, which is what my blog really focuses on. Other than that, you know, love walking, cycling, as you do, live in one of the most beautiful countries on the planet.
Yeah, yeah. Where do you live? Are you up in Oriwa area?
Sorry?
Where do you live?
Whangaparawa?
Whangaparawa, yeah. My daughter lives up in that area too.
Yeah, it's lovely. I mean, I've only been living here since August. I was in the UK before, and I was in Canada for a while as well. But yeah, photography, all kinds of things. Church as well. We're very involved in church. We're supposed to go to a home group tonight, but unfortunately, not going to be able to make it now. But there you go.
Oh, yeah. Because of our technical difficulties. Wow. Sorry about that.
Maybe I'm not meant to go.
Right. Do you have any children, you and your wife?
No, Kirsty and I met quite late in life. So we just sort of, I wouldn't say dodged a bullet because that's not the right way of looking at it, but it didn't happen. And, you know, that's where we are. So, yeah, cats.
All right. Cool. Well, before we jump into the topic, what do you mean by near-death experiences? Does that mean that do they die? Does the person almost die? Do they stop breathing? Are there no brain waves? How would you define that?
So, yeah, this is a very important question because there's a lot of experiences which people sometimes classify as a near-death experience, which isn't. And there's been discussions over the years. I mean, the term was originally coined by Kenneth Ring in his first book in 1975, which analyzed, he was a psychologist who had been interviewing patients and come to realize that this was a common phenomenon with common themes. And they're all patients who had died somewhere or another through either in a car accident or an operation. operating table and been resuscitated and come back to life. And the experiences which they recorded or reported or remembered either happened during that period of death or in immediate proximity to it, usually afterwards while they were in coma. So that's where the term near-death experience comes from. And it's a phenomenon that, you know, there are examples of it going back throughout history, but they're very rare. But it's a phenomenon that became very common from the late 1950s onward, when patients for the first time who suffered heart attacks were able to be resuscitated, because before that we didn't have adequate resuscitation techniques. So really, and it's been attempts recently to redefine it. So Sam Parnier, who's one of the leading researchers, clinical researchers into near-death experiences, he's an emergency room physician, and a lot of his research is in resuscitation techniques. He's redefined it as recorded experiences of death. So, you know, they've tried to classify it much more specifically as experiences, recollections which people have, then the patient had to have died. They had to have had a cardiac arrest and obviously been revived. And that the experiences would have to be either during or in proximity to that. Some people and have
do they separate something else. The cardiac from the brain. My mom, when she passed a few years ago, they were monitoring both the heart and the brain waves, and they didn't go simultaneously.
Interesting. Well, I mean, so which order did they go in? Because that would be an interesting case.
Boy, now you want me to use my memory. I don't recall. I really don't recall. Yeah.
Was she in a coma before
no,
that?
No, she had passed, and they resuscitated her. She was on life support. And then when we pulled the plug on her, we were looking at the monitor, and my wife was looking at her face, and the two didn't correspond exactly. I think my wife said, "Nope, she's gone." But it still showed something going on. It was just a little different, a little glitchy.
I mean, it's an interesting area, and it's been research into it. And people who are skeptics have tried to use research into this, particularly a researcher called Lima Borjigin, who's actually in Minnesota. And so there's been work looking at when brain activity stops. The early work was done in rats, and they showed that there is some residual brain activity in rats up to about 20 to 30 seconds after the heart has stopped. In another study in which they looked at coma patients, and this study was published, I think, 2 or 3 years ago, patients, you know, with the permission of their relatives, and who sadly, you know, gone beyond the point of any ever having any future, were on life support. Sounds very similar to, you know, obviously your mother, which is, you know, and the relative said, "No, it's time. We're time to say goodbye." And so they turn the machine off. And what you see in that period, immediately after turning it off, is you see brain activity, and it'll suddenly start to spike. And then it slows down. It becomes very disorganized. But all meaningful brain activity, any brain activity that could support consciousness in these, I think, 4 patients, stopped before the heart completely stopped. What's really important to understand is that the brain is the most power-hungry organ in the body. It requires more blood and more power than any other organ in your body. And consciousness, the highest level of brain power, would be the first thing to go. So people suffer syncope when their heart rate goes below about 30 to 35. So syncope is fainting. It's because the body says, right, we don't need consciousness right now. We need to be able to monitor temperature and all the metabolic functions that the brain also controls. So, you know, consciousness, it's not possible when you have no heartbeat. And even prior to the heart stopping, if the heartbeat is very low, then you will lose consciousness. So when someone has a cardiac arrest, and what recent studies, which Sam Parnier has done, and Charlotte Marshall, who's a skeptic, is just, I think he's going to publish in the next month or so, they do show that patients, they've actually been able to do EEG on patients who have died, had a cardiac arrest, and then they've tried to resuscitate them. So in the immediate period after cardiac arrest, you do not see any brain function. So there cannot be any consciousness.
Okay. So that's it. Brain function is flat. Mm.
If you apply really rigorous CPR, mm-hmm. it's possible that you do see brain function. And so Sam Parnier in some groundbreaking work showed that when patients were receiving CPR, up to 60 minutes after cardiac arrest, patients still were having some brain function. There was no associated recollections. And the patients who had NDEs either didn't have EEG recorded with it, or they didn't have any EEG readout. So there's been no connection between and brain activity after death.
So say that again. There's been no connection between NDEs and brain activity after death. Okay.
No.
Okay.
Any connections that have been made in the media or by skeptical scientists is, you know, really getting causation and association.
Yeah.
Blah, blah, blah.
Sure.
Ultimately, the data which has been got is in these patients who are receiving CPR. I believe it's the brain trying to reboot. So, you know, it would first of all try to reboot the heart. It would mm-hmm. try to reboot all the metabolic processes and everything else. And it's very unlikely that it was doing conscious things. And usually in patients who have these episodes of CPR-related consciousness, they will have memories of actually what's going on in the theater. There'll be very distorted memories. They'll experience pain because they're getting chest compressions. And they'll be very confused. They will not be the kind of coherent, organized memories that people get from NDE.
That makes sense. I forgot to ask, but how did you get involved with this? I mean, you've got a PhD in organic medicinal chemistry. You worked on life-saving medicines. And how did you find yourself interested in this field?
Yeah, my father had an NDE when he was younger, and he told me about it when I was in my early teens. It's always fascinated me. And, you know, I guess I'm genuinely curious and puzzled by the big questions in life. You know, I don't accept things blindly. I am a committed Christian. I believe that Jesus was exactly who he said he was, that he was God in the flesh.
Yeah. And you're also a committed scientist. So those two can sometimes
exactly. And I mean, organic chemists. So as you know, I've got another book, which I wrote, which is on the origins of life, and my expertise was in DNA and so on. And so I think that the three big scientific conundrums are the origin of the universe and everything in time, mm-hmm. and they haven't really adequately answered that. The origin of life, and they most definitely haven't answered that, and it's impossible by natural means, as I show in my other book, and many others have shown as well. And then the nature and origin of consciousness, and NDEs are very much related to that, and they're the one, and particularly the out-of-body experience element of NDEs, are the one experience or, you know, piece of evidence that we have that points to dualism, the idea that the consciousness is a separate entity to the body. And I know that there are people who hold on to the fact that body and soul are one and that we reincarnated together. I'm not going to get into that, but this specifically relates to the idea that the consciousness can exist outside of the body, which is physiologically impossible by natural means.
Yeah. I mean, there are many that hold that consciousness is just a function of your mind, the gray matter.
Yeah. And this basically, NDEs, if proven real, or rather the out-of-body experience, if proven real, completely blow that out of the water. It blows materialism apart, very much like actually the evidence around origins of life also blows materialism apart. But people are less inclined to engage with the data and the science because it is highly complex.
Yeah.
Whereas this is something I think that people can get their noodles around and perhaps grasp some of the concepts that are involved. So yeah, it's my father that really kicked it off though. And he was an honest man. He was a Christian. He became a Christian after I became a Christian, but he was an honest man. And, you know, he had a real NDE, very much in line, very similar to what other people describe.
Wow.
And then I started reading books and I got very, very interested. I had a girlfriend who had an NDE and I got very, very interested in it.
Mm.
And that's how it sort of sprouted. Yeah.
Okay. That's cool. And so what the central thesis of your book, you know, near-death experiences, the evidence from near-death experiences, what would you call the central thesis? Are you just exploring cases or what? Because like I said, I have not
read
two
books. There's two books. So okay. I wrote one book is NDE, the evidence around near-death experiences or proof of the soul and God. And the other is Did Jesus Die for Nothing? So the first book is aimed at people who aren't Christian and who are just curious about the subject of NDEs and then how that relates to God and God's existence. And the second book is specifically aimed at Christians who want to know more about NDEs and what NDEs say about Christianity and what Christianity says about NDEs and where to go with that. So in the first book, and to an extent in the second book, I explore the evidence for near-death experiences. And what I specifically focus on is two key sets of evidence. The first is scientific evidence as reported in four major studies now have looked into this. And two of these had within those studies, reports of people who had out of body experiences that were validated by healthcare professionals. One was in the Aware One study by Sam Parnier, which was published, I think, in 2014. And the other was in Pim van Lommel's study, which was in Holland. And that was published in, 2001. Yeah. And both of these were validated either by doctors or other healthcare professionals.
Yeah.
Where patients who could not have seen the things that they reported to see reported these events and the doctors corroborated them.
That's funny. I remember when I was a kid seeing, I think it was called Beyond and Back.
Right.
And that one person had died and described what the rooftop of that hospital was looking like, a tennis shoe or something like that. And I'll never forget that. It was just like, really?
Yeah, that's Maria's shoe. Yeah, it's a very famous NDE.
Okay.
I mean, again, it was a healthcare professional who corroborated it. I've forgotten her name. Jan Holm, I can't remember. But it was someone who it was corroborated by a healthcare professional. And it's the thing. So you've got different kinds of evidence. You've got anecdotal evidence, which is the kind that you talk about, where people reported these experiences. They ended up in the press or ended up in one of the books, you know, like Life After Life, or one of the many other books that have been written on a subject, or increasingly on YouTube, or on one of the websites which gathers these accounts.
Yeah.
And then you have scientific studies which are looking to understand the experience.
Yeah. Well, I would imagine it would be hard or impossible to set up what we would consider a truly scientifically rigorous experiment with colorblind and controls, because you don't ever know who's going to have an NDE.
Well, that's it. So, you raise a whole, you know, Pandora's box of problems with that. And so there have been attempts to try and objectively, using the scientific method, to validate the out-of-body experience part of NDEs. So, you know, first of all, in the 2001 Aware study, or rather not 2001, it was 2014, it was published, it started in 2008. And this was Dr. Sam Parnier, who's, you know, highly respected physician in his own right. Mm-hmm. He set up the study, it was in a number of different hospitals, and they had shelves that were, you know, high up in various rooms throughout the hospital, and they had pictures of objects on top of the shelves. And the idea was that if someone had an out-of-body experiences and were looking down on themselves from above, they would see the picture on the shelves, be able to report that, and that would validate the hypothesis that the consciousness is able to separate from the body.
Yeah.
So scientific method is basically you come up with, you observe things. So you have the original observations, these people who had reported these experiences. So you've got all these observations. So you get a hypothesis to explain it. So there are two major competing hypotheses. One is that the brain produces those experiences. The other is that the consciousness separates from the body. Yeah. And records these things. So if you were to prove that second hypothesis, you would conduct an experiment. And so the one study was looking at that. Now, you know, they had thousands and thousands of in-hospital cardiac arrests, but only in the end, they had 100 patients who they were able to interview, because most of them either died or they didn't take part in the study, or most of them died.
Right.
Most patients have cardiac arrests end up dying. It's you know, simple, unfortunate fact. And then out of those who die, and this is a well-established statistic now, particularly in the elderly, who are the most ones most common to get cardiac arrests, only about 10% report having a near-death experience.
Okay.
So if you've got 100, you've immediately whittled it down to 10 people. So it's a big study. They had thousands and thousands of people they tried to recruit, but obviously it didn't happen. And then about of those who have near-death experiences, only 25% of those tend to report an out-of-body experience, which is one of the core elements of a near-death experience. And so if you've got 100 patients, you would expect 2.5 people to report an out-of-body experience, which is exactly what happened. Two people reported out-of-body experiences. And then one of them was very, very good. I mean, he reported he was unconscious, documented no heartbeat, And during, he reported events happening during that time, conversations. He observed a doctor who came in and went out that had never been present while he was conscious. And so he saw things that he couldn't possibly have seen.
Did he see the pictures?
Yeah, great question. No.
I can't get off of that.
I'm getting there.
Okay.
I'm teasing, but no, he didn't. And the reason was that there was no picture in that room. So in fact, 78% of the cardiac arrests that occurred in that study occurred in rooms without the picture. So Sampanier went back and redesigned the study. And in these studies, again, I think about 20 hospitals were recruited into this. So there's an enormous interest from doctors in this subject because a lot of them have had people report these things. And they said there's no way that that could have happened without it being real. And so there's a lot of support for this kind of research. There's less support for being vocal about saying it's real because they're scared of what would happen to their careers.
I can imagine. Have you had any pushback on your career? Not really,
but then I've not really tried to progress beyond the state which I've been in, which I'm very happy with, which is in medical science. And people are genuinely interested. And I think nowadays there's a little bit more openness to it. Actually, I think people are we're entering a post-materialist era. So I think it's less divisive.
It's funny. My daughter suggested a Spotify series called The Telepathy Tape by Dr. Diane Henny Powell. And it's very fascinating to listen to the stories of mostly autistic people with telepathic skills. And
yeah.
She seems really credible, but man, she just got body slammed, so to speak, with her career. Her medical license was suspended for a while before they even read her material. So it was just incredible how materialism has so entrenched itself in the scientific community.
Yeah, it has. And it is, there's a lot of bias and there's a lot of, even within this field, there are people who post absolute garbage and certain parts of the press will dutifully report it as evidence against near-death experiences. And it just isn't. I'm a scientist and I can see that.
Yeah.
And it's even more prevalent in the origins of life research where they're very, they're fiercely defending Darwinianism. Yeah. I'm actually related to Charles Darwin.
Are you?
Through my father's side, Wedgwood. He was actually a Wedgwood. He was his mother was a Wedgwood. I don't really get involved in the Darwin argument. I don't want to get off on that. I'd love to do
another podcast on that. We'll talk about Dr. James Tour. We'll talk about all that stuff.
Yeah, but there is a lot of, they're very defensive. Their whole world is built around a materialist ideal. But
did you say that that's a kind of a, there's a, it's reached a tipping point? Do you think that's on its way out, or at least they're...
I think that there is one of the problems was that the church had caused a lot of damage and had not done itself any favors historically. But I think that the memory of that and the association of that is sort of left in previous generations. So Gen X and older. I'm Gen X, so I'm, and I think that Gen Z and millennials are much more open to spirituality. But on the same side, they haven't really been exposed to, Christianity to the same extent. But I think they're really genuinely open to it. And I think there's a lot of, and even you see that Elon Musk, who used to be quite atheist, is now openly discussing, that it's quite obvious that the universe was an act of creative intelligence. I mean, he said something along those lines in a podcast or something recently. And he subscribes to the philosophy that we're living in a simulation. And I actually address that in my book, Did Jesus Die for Nothing?
Oh, I'd like to read that part.
And it's you can't disprove it. It's definitely a valid hypothesis to explain.
It's unfalsifiable, isn't it?
It's, yeah, exactly. So to try and falsify it, you just look stupid. But you can just say, well, my personal experience points to a loving God. No. Anyway, let's not go on to that one for the moment. But what I'm saying is that if people like Elon Musk, who are, respected scientists in their own right, he's a great engineer and a genius in many ways, are starting to open themselves to this idea. And I think more and more, it is more widespread. And I talk to scientists all the time. I work with doctors and many of my colleagues are PhDs or MDs or PharmDs. And many of them believe in something, they believe there's more to existence. And I think science has revealed that to a lot of people. I think a lot of people now have an understanding that it's just not possible for the systems that we have to come into being that way.
What are some of the scientific pushback on the topic that it's oxygen deprivation or just hallucinations ketamine abuse or what?
So there's lots of potential explanations that have been given. So, release of various neurotransmitters around the time of death, use of various drugs. So ketamine is quite often used in an analgesic or just to, you know.
Yeah, my wife once broke her ankle and they put her on ketamine and she was seeing Iron Man in windows and seagulls took her leg off to back to California.
That's not uncommon. So you've got oxygen deprivation as well, which can cause, again, like hallucinatory type state. And there's all these different things that they provide as potential explanations. But when you look at those analogs, what you see, or when you look at those examples, you do not see the same kind of structured accounts that people have from NDEs. NDEs follow a very tight narrative arc, which is described by core elements or other things. So people go through a sequence of events. They have what they experience hyperreality, where they see things and hear things in detail that they never have in real life. They do not, and they report similar things, not the same things, which is very important, but they report similar things from the other side. And what more importantly than anything else is these out-of-body experiences. There is no drug. There are drugs, and you can have, let's say, there's epilepsies where you can have something which is similar to an out-of-body experience, but all it is you see an elongated sense of yourself, and so you see yourself extending. You don't see your head. You don't see yourself from outside. You have some sort of vision of yourself, but it's very, very different from an out-of-body experience. And more importantly than anything else, outside of NDEs, there have been no validated out-of-body experiences. So going back to your original question or types of evidence, so you've got scientific evidence for NDEs, which are very limited, and I'd argue none, because it hasn't been proved using the scientific method, which, as I started saying, was you have observations, create a hypothesis for those observations, and then you then create an experiment to test that hypothesis. So the experiment in this case is either putting those pictures in the rooms, or more recently a study with an iPad projecting to upwards images. In both of those studies, there are insufficient numbers to be able to get to a point where you could definitively show one way or the other. So that there's no scientific evidence, but you've got empirical evidence, right? And empirical evidence is, reliable observational evidence. And so what I would regard as reliable observational evidence is when you have a patient who reports an account, and that patient is someone who might be reliable. So police officer, fireman, doctor themselves, or a professional, someone of good standing in the community as a patient. And then the events that they report are then verified by a healthcare professional, ideally a doctor or a nurse, again, someone whose career is not going to rely on them fabricating account, and that they would say that those events were impossible for that person to have seen because they had no heartbeat or in a deep coma and were unable to see those things. And so that's empirical evidence of a very strong nature. And when you have one, maybe not. But when you have dozens, that starts to become very strong evidence. When you have hundreds and hundreds of these cases where doctors have been prepared to go on the record and state that, there's no way that this could happen by natural means, then you have overwhelming evidence, in my view. And there's a book by Titus Rivas called The Self Does Not Die, where he has these accounts, and he went back to the doctors. He went back to when the patients were contactable, and he got as much information as possible. And he got, I think there's over 130 in there. And there are many, many more than that. I've met doctors who have said they've had these and they just can't explain it. Why Sam Parnia became interested, because he came across these accounts. So I think, while we don't have the scientific evidence yet, there's absolutely overwhelming empirical evidence that supports the fact that the out-of-body experience during near-death experiences is real.
Yeah.
Now, your question about evidence against. So going back to those, there's no explanation which matches the near-death experience, which comes close to whether it be oxygen deprivation, whether it be the drugs being used, or whether it be release of neurotransmitters, hallucination, dream states. None of these things are analogous to near-death experiences. There might be some similarities. There are certainly spiritual elements to things like ketamine and mushrooms and whatnot.
Would it be analogous to the supposedly explanations around the resurrection of Christ, you know, the empty tomb and all that stuff?
Yeah.
The swoon theory and all that. They don't really answer.
No, they don't. And I think the, you know, again, they're clutching at straws. And then the other work that's been done is going back to your very sort of first question of, and around related to your mother's passing, whether there's brain activity after death, and that there is no evidence that there's sufficient brain activity in humans to support any form of consciousness, let alone the complex nature of consciousness that would be required to firstly generate these experiences and secondly remember them. And so, you know,
somebody wakes up, you know, they're revived. How do we know that the brain hasn't immediately formed some memory or something, you know?
Yeah. I mean, again, if you have, and you know, that argument has a certain amount of validity that could potentially happen.
Yeah. But they certainly see tennis shoes on the roof.
Why would they remember? Yeah, exactly. It's a shoe on the roof. There are better examples than that. So Chris Yeaston, I mean, there's so many amazing examples. I do recommend, if you're interested in this subject,
I'm going to read your book. An abbreviated version of a teaser story.
Yeah. I mean, the Self Does Not Die is really good as well. It's not my book. It's Titus Rivas. Okay. It's really excellent because there's all these cases that are documented. And you've got Maria's tennis shoe in there, which is the one you talk about. But it's got, you know, I think it's Chris Yeaston, who was, anaesthetist. Uh-huh. And basically this guy had gone under and, you know, he was dead. And when he came back, he was really excited and he got this Chris Yeaston guy and he said, I saw you in the operating theater. And he said, no, you couldn't, you were completely unconscious. He says, well, I did. He says, well, not just that. I was above my body. He said, I don't know how long it's for. It felt like ages. And I was above this light. And I was there so long that I remember the serial number on the lights. And no. Chris Yeaston went back and he checked, he went into the theater and then he got the serial number right. He also remembered conversations. Wow. There's another example of a doctor in, I think it's New Jersey or New York, who, he was reviving someone and then he went to the bed a few days later and the guy said, oh, this amazing experience, but the experience was so good. I wanted to know that it's real. And for a time I was in the room and in the ER and I noticed that there was a dusty quarter on top of a cabinet that was really high up. So it wasn't something that a nurse would see or something like that.
Sure.
And it was a 1985 quarter. It was very specific. And I said, I just want to know that all the other stuff was real. And if that's real, then all these other amazing things that happened to me are real. And sure enough, the doctor went there and he looked at it, found the quarter, 1985 quarter. And there are a number of cases in this book that are like that. Wow. That amazing, that dramatic. And there were these are real doctors who've gone on the record. And then you've got hundreds and hundreds of cases like this. And so to say that these aren't real, you have to come to two conclusions. One, the doctors are stupid. So the most highly trained, highly intelligent, highly skeptical people on the planet. I work with these guys all the time. I work with doctors. It's my bread and butter. I'm a medical scientist in my profession. And I work with doctors and I discuss evidence and they are skeptical, right? They will never take what you say as read without, you know, good support. So they wouldn't just accept something like this, especially not from patients. You know, they're very, very skeptical of, you know, they always have their own sort of position on these things. So they're either duped really easy, hundreds and hundreds, if not thousands of them, or they're in on a conspiracy to deceive people in a profession where it goes against everything that would be advantageous to them to do that, or these things really happened.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, as a rational human being, I can only conclude that these things happened and that they're real and that that is evidence enough. And I do believe that it won't be that long before we have scientific validation as well.
Yeah, it sounds like it. I mean, it sounds like they're going to have to put something in every one of the rooms in the hospital because you never know where it's going to strike, right?
Well, this is the problem. So in the latest iteration of the AWARE study, which is again conducted by Sam Parnier, they had a team that was dedicated to going to someone who had an ER, someone who had
Indeed.
Cardiac arrest, going to the ER. They would take a specially created crash cart, which had equipment on it, which had an iPad, which looked up at the ceiling. They could connect EEG equipment and measure brain activity. They could measure oxygenation of the brain, and they put earbuds in and play sounds and all kinds of things. Problem was, it takes about 4 or 5 minutes to get there. And so actually a lot of what happens in the first four, most people either get resuscitated or don't in the first 4 or 5 minutes. If they don't get resuscitated in the first 4 or 5 minutes, they're more likely to die.
Yeah.
Secondly, the out-of-body experience, it follows sequential, or the NDEs follow a sequential number of experiences. So the first element is always the out-of-body experience. It's immediately after cardiac arrest, the out-of-body experience occurs. Sometimes it can last for a long time. Sometimes they then go on to the other elements.
What's a long time? Minutes?
Minutes, yeah, many minutes. And sometimes people are literally left wandering the hospital corridors for hours, because that's what they've reported. They've gone into other rooms and witnessed
conversations. Hang on. So slow on this. Their body has actually scientifically been dead for how long?
Well, okay. All right. So sometimes they're in a coma or they're undergoing CPR, but they died at some point.
Okay.
Now, again, that's a different question. It's a very interesting question. Lots of ethical questions. So, going back to the definition of death, before CPR, death was death. You had a cardiac arrest, you died, that was it, game over.
Yeah.
With CPR, the definition of death has changed. So, the death now is really, you've got permanent death and clinical death. Clinical death is where you've no longer got a heartbeat or brain activity. So it's like a computer without any power.
Yeah.
It's not functioning, but if you plug the power back in, it'll start again. And as long as you provide... Actually, it's arguable you don't even need to provide oxygenated blood. It's about the a lot of damage which is done when people are revived is due to reperfusion injury, which is the sudden circulation of oxygenated blood into places where there hasn't been oxygenated blood, and it can cause lots of damage. So I don't know if you've heard of the pig brain experiment, where some guys from Harvard, they went to an abattoir and they got these pigs that had been dead for a few hours, cut their heads off, and then used a solution to reperfuse gently oxygen into the brains, and the pig brains started to become active. These were just heads, right? It's a very famous experiment. And so what it showed was that there is the potential for person to be revived hours. And there's just been people have gone into lakes, suffered cardiac arrest, frozen lakes, suffered cardiac arrest, had no heartbeat 4 hours and been revived very, very slowly. So Aga Bagenholm, I think she was in Norway, and there was a very famous instance where I can't remember the exact circumstances, but a load of kids went into a lake, whether they were skating or something, and most of them died. And most of them were revived very carefully and slowly after sometimes 45 minutes or an hour. They were warmed up very, very slowly and they recovered. Okay. So you can be done. And then there are actual operations now where they put people into deep hypothermic circulatory arrest, where they cool the body down. The heart stops beating. They're dead. They have no brain activity at all. They measure that very carefully. Mm-hmm. People do have experiences during this, akin to near-death experiences. So the definition of death has changed.
Yeah.
So I've gone way off on a tangent there, but I think really potentially to freeze someone correctly and then thaw them correctly, you could potentially keep someone indefinitely in a state of limbo. What happens to their consciousness is then the ethical question.
Yeah. Let me get into the area of where this, because NDEs, they're not unique to any particular culture, region, or religion, right? I mean, does it bother you that the Christians, the Hindus, the Buddhists, the atheists, they report them? It doesn't necessarily support any one religious worldview, does it? I mean, some report Jesus, others report Hindu figures, other vague light beings.
Yeah.
How do you interpret that?
Yeah. So, that is the question that I had buzzing around my head for a very, very long time.
Yeah.
Because you're right. It does really challenge that. And it created this state of cognitive dissonance in me. And the book that I wrote, which is Did Jesus Die for Nothing, addresses that precise question. And it goes into that specifically, because you are right that particularly the NDE community, but NDEs themselves, to an extent, support the idea of universalism. There'll be Christians who say it doesn't. And there are Christians who will say, well, the NDEs which don't support Christianity are demonic. And only the I just don't buy that, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, there are children who have these experiences. Mm. And, you know, there are atheists who have Christian-like experiences. A very famous one, Howard Storm, who became a Christian after his experience. There are people who are Christian who have experiences which cause them to become less religious afterwards. So
really,
yeah, they're YouTube's notorious. I now don't watch any of them on YouTube because you don't know which ones are made up,
yeah,
which ones are biased, and so on. So I was in this state of cognitive dissonance for a very, very long time. And then I had an aha moment. My wife, usually your wife is the one.
Okay.
It's hesitating. She sort of posed two questions. So first of all, there's 10 different core elements of NDEs, which people tend to experience a number of, if not all, when they have a near-death experience. And one of those is the border beyond which they can't return. So they are told there's a border, literally like almost like a physical border in their NDE, where if they progress beyond that, they are told by the spirit beings, whatever they are, they're with angels, whatever they are, and I don't have a view on what they are, some Christians do, but that they're told if they go beyond that point, they can't return. So that for me is, and my wife said, you know, why is that? You know, what lies beyond that? What where are they before then? So that's the first question that sort of really started to stir my thinking on this. And the second, again, my wife sort of pointed me towards this, is about free choice. So if, and I do believe this is going to happen, I will believe that NDEs have been proven beyond reasonable doubt.
You say you do not or you do?
They've been proved real, right?
You do, okay.
Okay, they've been proved real beyond reasonable doubt, okay? From what I described, the empirical evidence. And therefore, I believe it is highly likely that at some point in the near future, they will be proven scientifically. Now, you know, when that is, who knows? At that point, you know, millions, if not billions, are going to suddenly have a massive mind flip and suddenly realize there's something going on and that the consciousness survives, and then we're going to start thinking about the implications. If everyone came back, Hindus, Muslims, whatever, they all came back and said, oh, yeah, you've got to believe in Jesus. Free choice is removed. Free will no longer exists. So, you know, and I go into the philosophy of this quite a lot in my book, and I believe it's supported by scripture, and I believe that it's supported by experience and observation. You know, life really is about finding God. That's our primary purpose, is to find God through Jesus. And many of us are given the opportunity to encounter Jesus. And if we reject that, we are told that, you know, there are consequences. And if we don't reject him, we accept Jesus and we follow him, then we're told we go to heaven. Now, obviously, there's a lot of people who never get that experience properly. And there are passages in the Bible which talk about that. And they could be Hindus, they could be Muslims, and they will be judged perhaps in a different way. So, you know, people who are Christian, I believe the Bible, Jesus specifically says that they will not be judged or they will not be condemned in judgment. Whereas people who, and he talks about being, you know, people who obviously didn't know the commands and disobeyed them will be lashed with fewer or lashed less.
Judged less severely, harsh. Sure.
And also he says, he talks about when he's sending his disciples out, and I got the quote somewhere, but I haven't got it right in front of me. And he says that, you know, if they don't know, if they haven't been told, then they do not know, then how can they have been told they've sinned? And so ultimately, the I can't remember the exact phrase, but if you turn it around, if they don't know what sin is, how can they have sinned? And so if they haven't been given the message, how do they know what sin is? So I do think that it is, and other Christians might disagree with this, but I don't really care. And I think that it's supported by scripture to an extent. The people who have never truly encountered Jesus or have been so put off him by bad Christian behavior, and there are plenty of examples of that, who nevertheless live a life by listening to the Holy Spirit, because God is present everywhere, that they will receive perhaps a less harsh judgment, and maybe there'll be an opportunity for them. I don't know. I'm not going to say there is, because I don't know that. But what I do not believe is completely in universalism. And so I've got a lot of evidence I talk about in my book for this. So first of all, NDEs come back with a lot of contradictory evidence.
Yeah.
Some people say everyone goes to heaven.
Right. Yeah.
They say, oh, my spirit guide says, oh, no, there's no hell. Everyone goes to heaven. And yet about 25% of people who have near-death experiences report of a hell-like experience. And they are, and Sam Parnia, who I have a lot of respect for as a researcher, says, oh, well, these aren't real near-death experiences. They are CPR-induced visions. But they're not, because every other aspect of their experience is identical to NDEs. They'll often have out-of-body experiences. They'll experience things in hyper-real states. They'll go through a tunnel. And so, and they describe it as more real than reality. So first of all, you have a contradiction there. You'll have one NDE saying, oh, no, everyone goes to heaven.
Yeah.
Another one saying, yeah, actually, some people are going to hell. And then you'll have people report completely different things as well about different states. Some people describe themselves as being orbs of light floating around the universe. Others, you know, they say all kinds of things. So I've come to the conclusion on this that, you know, some people say it's demonic activity. I don't know. Some people say, as I was saying, only the ones that are, you know, talk about Jesus are real. I think people are allowed to have all different kinds of experience to create something akin to what we experience in real life, which is ultimately that we don't really have a clear idea.
Yeah.
We're given free choice.
It remains a mystery.
Yeah.
Well, when I knew I was going to do a podcast with you, I just started, you know, Googling it and looking up things, and it brought up a lot more questions than answers, you know, very interesting topic. Can these NDEs with people that have a universalistic experience or whatever, does that match with their preconceived theology if they had one, or cultural expectation?
No.
There's no match.
I think, you know, there are themes that are consistent. People come back who were in a very religious type of church environment, a Christian environment, come back feeling less religious. I don't know if their faith as such has changed, but they're less religious. A lot of people say they spoke to God and God told them, well, you know, there are plenty of ways to find me. Jesus is the right way, but there are, you know, anyone who truly seeks me will find me, you know. And so I think, you know, there's sufficient. What I would say is that there are consistent truths that come from NDEs. Now, I've got the list, but do you mind if I just read it out? There's core truths that most NDEs will have in common. So the first is that consciousness can survive death. We don't know if it can be eternal. We know that it can survive death for a period of time. Therefore, it's an independent entity. We also know that there are clearly spiritual realms. We don't know whether this is the real heaven or whether it's just glimpses of what heaven might be. You know, Paul talks about being taken up into the third heaven. Did he have something like this? Jesus said, only the Son of Man has come from heaven and survived, you know. So Jesus is the only one who said he's the only one who's been to heaven, has come back. God's heaven. And again, we talk about the boundary. So there are different spiritual realms. There's hell as well. These are common things that are called truths. Many people talk about a supreme being that is a being of ultimate consciousness and love that shares what we would describe as the characteristics of the God that we know in the Bible, right? He's a God of love, God of compassion, a God of forgiveness, a God of justice, God of infinite wisdom and creativity. People describe him in those terms. Yeah, there's a hellish realm. There's a life review, but it doesn't feel like judgment. Again, these are people who came back. They didn't die. Would they experience judgment had they died? But these are common.
Do they change afterwards? Are they more compassionate, more religious, whatever?
Kind of like that George Bailey. They definitely have more belief in the spiritual world. Many of them will believe in God afterwards, not all of them. They will almost always be more compassionate and less materialistic because their experience was so real to them, but they understand this reality is something completely different now.
Yeah. And what happens with the people that become less religious? That's interesting to me.
Well, they still believe in life after death. They still believe in heaven. They still believe in God. They just don't believe necessarily in the religious practices that they, you know, conformed to beforehand the path to achieving that eternal status. Doesn't mean they stop going. They just have less sort of understanding of that being important.
Yeah, less dogmatically held beliefs, if you will.
Exactly. You know, yeah. And I think there's a lot of Christians who, you know, agree with that. I do to an extent. I see Catholics talking and they're born again. You know, I see people who call themselves born again Christians and you shudder at the things they say. So, but the reality is that religion is, and this is where Parnia, who he's really hostile towards religion in general, and he says that NDEs basically transcend religion. And, you know, in some ways he has a point, but that NDEism itself, you know, there's no methodology. Religion, if you look at it from the strictest sense, is the teachings, example, and ways of living given by the founder. So you've got Muhammad, you've got the Buddha, you've got Krishna, whatever, and then you've got Jesus. And, you know, you can, those, that's the religion. And if you look at Jesus, he was very unreligious.
Yeah.
He was the least religious out of all of the Jews of the time, really. Detested religion. So, however, we've made a religion out of what he said and everything else. But you need practices. You need to pray. You need to read the Bible. You need practices to get into God and his thinking and his ways. So NDEism doesn't offer that. You've got the new age sort of thinking, and that's just like herding cats in your mind. It's, you know, it's garbage. So what I did in my book is I did a bit of a, you know, back of an envelope comparative analysis of these core truths. And I looked at the different religions, the different five major religions. So I looked at Hinduism, Buddhism, Islam, Judaism, and Christianity. And when you actually look at that, and you look specifically at the teachings and example of the founders, only Jesus actually is consistent with all of these core truths that come from NDE. And then I went further and I said, well, what does Jesus say that contradicts NDEs? And there's quite a number of things, and universalism is definitely one of them. And then I look at there's something that definitely is unique about my writing and which does cause controversy and people don't like. And that's around the issue of the fact that only 10% of elderly adults recall NDEs, right?
Mm-hmm.
However, children, and this was research done by a guy called Melvin Morse, about 85 to 90% who have a cardiac arrest recall their NDEs, right? And then there are other studies which have been done on different age groups.
What do you make of that? That's just strange.
Yeah. So it's a linear decline. So people when the average age of the study was about in their late 30s, I think it's 47% remembered, or 50% or something like that. So it's a linear, it's literally a linear decline, completely linear decline from childhood to elderly, to old age, right?
Mm-hmm.
And memory, changes in memory do not explain that. Neither does the drug. So, you know, there's been a lot of work done on changes in memory. I've worked in Alzheimer's in medicine. And unless you get Alzheimer's, your memory to remember that events occurred, and large events, most people, even if they've got poor, their memory got age-related memory loss, not dementia, they'll remember that something happened. So I'll give an example. So you've got a wedding, and in that wedding, you had bridesmaids, and you had the groom and the bride, and you had various attendees. A child will be able to recall all kinds of details about the wedding. They'll be able to remember the color of the bridesmaids' dresses. They'll be able to remember what the groom said and all these different things. They remember to remember all kinds of details. They've got a better functional memory for detail.
Mm-hmm.
Elderly adults, you know, may not be able to remember as many details. So there is age-related memory cross, but they'll remember they went to the wedding. They'll remember some of the vows that were made. They'll remember key elements of it. NDE is a life-changing moment.
Sure.
So that's the first thing. So it's not age-related. It's not drugs. There's no physiological explanation. Then the second thing that really, you know, twist your noodle, for want of a better expression, is the brain isn't working, right? How can memories be created when the brain isn't working? How can the brain remember things that occurred while it wasn't functioning? So that's a philosophical question. Where is memory actually recorded? Now you start to go into obviously sort of all kinds of territory, which is purely speculative. And I'm not saying there's any scientific evidence or anything to support this, but many NDEers report being able to experience things now through other people. They're able to experience other events that occurred that they were a part of through other people's perspective, as though they were actually that person, to feel what that person feels. So they're actually able to access in these near-death experiences the memories of other people. They're able to go to historical events and experience and witness them through the eyes of people who are there. Wow. Now,
I just had a thought. I don't want to break the train too much, but has there been any blind people with NDEs and out of bodies? Because that's... Yeah.
So there are instances of people who are blind and for the first time in their life were able to see things in an NDE.
Wow.
So they reported seeing things, they reported seeing colors for the first time and, you know, all kinds of things. So again, you know, that's really strong evidence.
That is.
For them being real. But, you know, there's a lot of hypothetical stuff, a lot of, you know, philosophical stuff that I do get into in my book, but it is purely speculative. It's purely what if, you know, what might it be? What might the explanations be? But going back to what you said about what could be going on and only 10% remembering, and I come up with it, there's a number of explanations. So, you know, an explanation provided is it's changing memory function, a physiological explanation. Well, I'm just sharing that it's not that. It can't be that. So what else could be going on? And if it's not physiological, there are two possible explanations. The person didn't have an NDE. They didn't have an experience. Their spirit, their consciousness did not leave their body and they didn't have an experience at all. So again, if that's the explanation, all children or most children seem to have them, but most elderly adults don't. Something is happening during life that is causing them to not have that experience. It may be that they don't need to have an NDE. It may be that the experience isn't necessary for them to, you know, make a step in this life. It may be that something has happened to them as people that means that their consciousness is no longer able to progress to the next stage, that they become hardened in the world, that the more life you live. So I, you know, you've got this expression, only the good die young. Well, you know, maybe only the young die good. So I don't know. It's a possible explanation. I'm not saying it is the explanation.
Yeah. It sounds like your research is both rewarding and frustrating at the same time. It raises a lot of questions that you can only hypothesize about.
There's one last explanation for this, and that's dissociative amnesia. I don't know if you're familiar with the concept, but
explain that.
So you have a car accident or you experience a trauma, sometimes your brain, to protect you from the, you know, long-lasting effects of that, will not allow you to remember it.
Okay, yeah, I've heard of
it. So if people have hellish experiences, it's possible they don't remember them. And it could be that as you get older, you're more likely, you know, I don't know. These are just potential explanations. Anyway,
That's very fascinating. Has your research changed how you live your life as a Christian or just as a person or your thoughts or your priorities or anything like that?
Oh, you know, I just have absolutely zero doubt in the fact that, you know, this life is not the true reality. It feels real. Mm-hmm. As a chemist, I understand that what we see isn't really what we see. We're seeing reflected light and we're not actually seeing solid objects at all.
Right.
So I, you know, I have a certain amount of understanding already from science that what we experience is somewhat of an illusion. And so my understanding is that this is a created experience, created by God, as it is described in the Bible, in which we live, where we are ultimately tested. So one of the difference in philosophy between NDEism and New Ageism is that Earth is a school and we're here to learn, eventually progress and we all go to heaven. Whereas the biblical explanation is that Earth is a test, it's an exam, and we're here to pass or fail. And that's my belief. I do believe, despite the universalist sort of claims of NDEism, that Jesus, believing in Jesus, is the only guaranteed way of surviving this life and potentially avoiding hell, which for the first time in history, we have eyewitness accounts of hell. People who've come back and said they've experienced hell, and it's horrendous. I mean, beyond anything you can imagine, just as the heavenly accounts are beyond anything we can imagine.
Yeah. Well, so I remember as a young Christian hearing stories about somebody who died and went to heaven and went to hell. And I remember, you know, one saying, like you said, oh, nobody under the age of 21 was in hell. And now you say there's some that say there's nobody in hell. So I just kind of leave it in the, I don't know, category.
So that's it. We don't know. And so bring up Pascal's wager. And I think that there is evidence here to believe what you want. You know, you can believe the universalist claims. There's enough evidence from NDEs to believe that. I'm not disputing that. But equally, it is consistent with the evidence from NDEs, science, and all our other experiences to believe that Jesus was exactly who the Gospels say he was, that he was God the Son, that only through him are we guaranteed salvation. I don't believe that it's exclusive. I do believe that, you know, while it only is that the only way to be guaranteed salvation, I believe personally that others will be saved, but there'll be a mechanism that we're not familiar with and that we can't promote it. And we can't say that that's definitely the case. If you're about it, it's too late. Because if you reject it, that's your chance gone. So, you know, I think the one thing that's perhaps changed me more than anything is these hellish accounts and how I approach things. So Jesus mentions hell, I think, about 15 times in the Bible. He mentions it more than any other character in the Bible. He mentions heaven 150 times, and he mentions love about 70 times. Now, I think modern churches have shied away completely from the subject of hell. And they got it wrong in the past. They were saying, you're all going to hell if you don't follow Jesus and you'll be judged and all the rest of it. And they got it wrong. Mm-hmm. But if we really love people, then we should be mentioning at least as much as Jesus did, because Jesus mentioned it because that's why he came, so that people wouldn't experience that, so that they would come to his kingdom, they would share in his kingdom and his ultimate creation, which we glimpse in other NDEs. So I think if anything, it's changed the sense of urgency that I have to share the gospel and to bring people to an understanding that they're here to make a choice. They need to look into it. They need to come to the choice themselves. They need to look at all the evidence and really look at the evidence of Jesus and be very careful about rejecting him, because the consequences may be very, very grave. And I think that's one of the things. And in terms of living my life, I know I try to live it, you know, as a Christian, I fail. But I'm just grateful that I have, you know, his forgiveness. And if I repent, you know, but I have people who've read my books and said it's changed their lives having read the books, because it's really made them realize that this reality is not all that we're led to believe it to be, and that we have empirical, you know.
Yeah, well, I think that alone, if you get people from that point, from materialism, you know, to believing the consciousness survives the death of the body, that's huge. Then you got to explore, okay, how do I make sure if my soul's going to live eternally, what's the best option out there? What religion makes the most sense of reality? And
yeah,
you know,
and I do a sort of back of the envelope analysis of that in my book. And I show why, you know, Jesus was, you know, that the one most closely, you know, aligned to those truths that we learn from near death experiences.
Mm, very good. Are there any questions you were hoping I was going to ask on the topic?
There are dozens of questions you can ask. I think I've covered most of the things. I think, you know, I would, you know, love people to be familiar with my, I've got two websites.
Where are they? Well, how can we find more on your work?
It is self-published, but I've had it professionally edited and whatnot. I don't even bother with publishers, because frankly, it's, you know, it's an absolute nightmare trying to get published. But, you know, lots of people have read them, but I'd love more to read them. They're available on Amazon and other sort of online book places and Kindle. So if you want to look into my books and you can link to Amazon. So it's orsonw.com. That's orsonw.com. And if you're a Christian and this is something you really want to get some more information, I recommend Did Jesus Die for Nothing? And I've got a website which is completely non-Christian, although now I have opened up discussions on religion in a separate thread, and people are very interested in that. And that's called awareofaware.com. So, you know,
aware of aware.com.
Yeah, because the aware studies were, well, you know, I might as well create a website about them.
Okay.
And it looks at the research into them. So, you know, there's a lot of really interesting discussions on that. It tends to be about the science of consciousness and things like that. So, yeah.
Yeah. Well, Orson, I'll ask you what I ask all my guests on the show. And what is it that waters your soul, so to speak, the most as a Christian? What revitalizes you and has the greatest impact on your spiritual life? Some people say prayer, some people say meditation, some walk. I've had all kinds of answers, but
worship.
And that is the traditional form in church, listening to music, saying the words.
In church, provided it's a church which is worship's led well and it's not stale.
Yep.
But at home, you know, I feel that in worship and in prayer as well, that's when I connect with God. And I, you know, it's like, I describe it as you make a connection. But it feels like, you know, I had someone say to me recently, oh, God's a narcissist because he demands we worship him. well, when you worship, you connect with him. It's like you connect this thread with God and with heaven. And in that connection, yeah, with honey flows down the thread into your soul, right? So as you worship him, he just gives to you much more than he ever gets from us.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, I, you know, for me, worship is the most important aspect, and all other things, all other aspects of the religion, reading the Bible, prayer, meeting with other Christians are important. But for me, worship is the one where I get the most rejuvenation in the spirit.
Awesome. Awesome. Well, Orson, it's been fantastic having you on the show. I appreciate that.
Thank you.
And appreciate your time. I want to have you back on, talk about some of your other topics as well.
Thank you.
So make sure, those of you out there, make sure you sign up and you know, don't miss future episodes where we're going to have other interesting guests on there. Until then, God bless.
For more reasons why we believe,
or to support this ministry, go to
thinkingmatters.org.nz.